Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 3, delivered on August 28, 2018. The title of this lecture is Markets.
Today, markets. To start this out, ma'am, do you use eBay?
Yeah.
I do too. I'm an eBay ho. I mean, I will go there and I will bid. You know what really bunches my boxers is when you're almost at the end, you got the high bid, and there's some creepy old lady who jumped your bid right in the last second. Really? I'll find you. But eBay is interesting because it's actually something that we use in research these days, because it's an example of a type of auction, actually two different types of auction. And there's even a third kind of auction that happens in here. Now, most people think of an auction, and if you have prowled my YouTube page, you'll see that I am actually a professional auctioneer. One of those people who talks real fast. Anyone, anywhere, want a bid? I need a bid. Give me a bid. It's 25. 25, 25. I got 25. Now 30. 30. I am selling this man for $30. Anyone want a bid? $30. Do I have $30? Well, hell. Sorry, 27. 27. Anyone, anywhere, want a bid? 27. Got nothing. Yeah, I do. Mostly these days I do charity auctioneering to raise money for scholarships for the school here. But now, auctions have different types, as I just said. There are three that we can distinguish fairly cleanly. There is a Dutch auction. There is an English auction. And then there is a sealed bid auction. Now, the difference doesn't sound right at first. An English auction reaches from low bid to high bid. So that's why let's do this formally. Sotheby's auction. We have on display a young man who will provide domestic services for the next year to the highest bidder. We will begin the bidding at $1,000. Do I have a bid of $1,000? No, you can't bid on your own ass. Okay, and then you work your way up from there. That's the classic auction, the English auction, the one where I do. We have the auction up at Bolingbroke, for example, for the Professional Sales Institute. And companies will donate very nice things for us to auction to these very wealthy alumni of Illinois State. They go golfing all day long, the big wigs and the alumni, and we get everyone three sheets to the wind, and then we feed them, and then we do a nice auction. And so in a case like that, I would be going from, essentially, I'll start a bid at something. Essentially, I'll look at the market price. What's this thing worth? And I'll find something well underneath it. And my job is to just get them to start rolling upward in their bids. So I might have a target in my mind. I want to try to bring the bidding up to $300. I got a bid of I'm starting this bidding out at 200. Anyone, anywhere want a bid? 200. I need a bid. Will you bid? I need a bid of 200. And someone will raise a hand. Okay, I got 200 now, 25. 25, 25, I need a bid of 225. Do you have 22, 25, madam? I need a bid of 225. You don't have any money? We'll go to you. And I'll just keep working my way up. That is an English auction. You're probing upward. And then at some point, you don't get any more bids. And I'm sitting there. I've gotten it up to 270, and I'm probing for 280. 280, anyone, anywhere, want a bid? 280, I need a bid. Anyone, anywhere, want a bid? 280, I need a bid of 280. No one says anything, so I go back. Okay, I got 270 going once, 270 going twice. Sold at 270. When I strike that gavel, That means that I am accepting the offer someone made. When you called 270, that was your offer. When I strike the gavel, I accept, and that closes the contract for this gentleman right here. Really? 270? I thought we could do better, but, you know. So that's an English auction. Now, that's the way eBay generally works. You're working your way up. Someone bids something. You bid over it. And you'll notice that the most successful sales, you start with a very low bid, and then you let people bid against each other. Quite frequently in an English auction, the final settle, the settling price, is above the value of the merchandise. In other words, you could usually buy what you bid on eBay, you could buy it at a cheaper price elsewhere, like Amazon. Why does that happen? It's called the winner's premium. You will bid, you get people to the point where they are bidding, and they put their ego into it, and they place value not on the item, but on the item plus the victory. That's the winner's premium. Sometimes we call it the winner's curse in English auctions. And that's why English auctions are actually fairly popular, because especially you'll see these paintings that are of famous artists or moderately famous artists, their paintings will go for insanely high prices, far beyond the talent of the artist. And forgive me for saying this, some of the master artists, oftentimes what's at auction are their crappy works. But we know that those rich people are going to place a value on winning that auction and then having the bragging rights. I won the auction at Sotheby's for this masterwork of Rembrandt. Well, no, that was actually what he was really sucking as an artist. This Van Gogh I got. Yeah, well, that was when he was absolutely crazy out of his mind. He was about to die from cancer. He couldn't even see straight. That's terrible work. But we get people at an auction, we'll drive them up way past value. That's the way it works. That's an English auction. Now, a Dutch auction works kind of the opposite. You're probing downward. Now, oftentimes, you see this on eBay with buy it now. Someone will sell something, but they'll say, all right, you buy it at this price. First to buy it wins it. And if no one buys it at that price during the time limit, let's say 7 days, well, the person will pull it and then wait a while, lick his wounds, and then bring it back at a lower price. Buy it now. That's what happened. I'm replacing my video drone for professional use, and someone put up a very nice Mavic at $810 2 months ago. No one's going to buy it at $810 because it's used, even though it's in excellent shape and he's got a very good record. So no one bought it. So sure enough, he shows up last week again. Buy it now, $719. That's very common in sealed bid in Dutch auctions. You're bidding your price downward. You are going to participate in Dutch auctions. When you sell your services, when you get your degree, you are actually more likely to be looking to offer the better, lower price for your services than another grad with a similar degree could offer. So that is you're going to be the victims, as it were, of Dutch auction. The sealed bid auction is a real pain in the butt. And I wrote a research paper on optimal bidding in sealed bid auctions. The math of it is staggering. It's game theory on crack. The mathematics, just pages and pages. And I can't remember how I did that. I think I was drunk because I don't remember a thing about that math I did. But anyway, a sealed bid auction, this is oftentimes the way contracts are handed out for projects. A city, well, we need this a street repaired, so we're going to put out a call for bids. And whoever wants to bid, just submit a bid. This is what, and so you're kind of like blind. Okay, I know what my costs are. What kind of a premium am I going to put on those costs but not so much that it's going to make me lose the contract? There's a famous story, and it was actually made into a movie. I cannot remember the name of the movie, but it was a couple of years ago. Back when we picked a fight with Iraq, and we decided we're going to attack this country for weapons of mass destruction, which they didn't really have, but whatever. And they put out a contract for weapons transporters, private companies that could transport weapons through the combat zones and to the places where the supply chain needed them. Well, these two guys who are like college grads, hardly any knowledge of anything, they put in a bid for $10 million. We'll do it for $10 million. And they won the contract. And when they met with the Pentagon officials said, well, I mean, you have absolutely no experience doing this, but your bid was the lowest of all the bids. And one of the two young men said, well, what was the next lowest bid? What was it? $180 million? Yeah, and you did $10 million. Well, when they walked out in the hall, they both started smashing their heads against the wall for what they had done. They had no idea where to put a bid, so they just put it what they thought, and it won. But, of course, then they had to drive weaponry and ordnance through insanely dangerous territory. Good movie. Unfortunately, they didn't die for their stupidity. Those are the kinds of contracts. I wrote one down here. I'm going to show you. Let me work on it. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we will do this work. Let's say there are, I need a parking lot paved at my company. So I'm just going to put out a call for bids, pave this parking lot. Well, she has a paving company. He has, you have, and you used to do it, except that last paving job you did, cars sank in and you kind of got out of the business and out of the town too. But okay, so then what will happen is that they'll all submit bids to me. 8,000, 5,000, 7,000, 6,000. But, you know, you're kind of like blind. I'll take the low bid. But the problem with that is that you're taking the low bid, and it might be because that company really sucks or that they have a bad reputation. But you're going to take the low bid. Cities do this. Private companies do this quite a bit. And our military does it. They'll take sealed bids for insanely dangerous stuff, but that's just the way it is in it. You got the idea?
Yeah.
It makes for efficiency, yes, but at the same time, sometimes the low bid isn't the most efficient bid in the world. So let me show you. I'm going to show you a Dutch auction. Now, this one would be, let's say that you want to place 500,000 shares of stock. You're a company, you want to find buyers, wealthy, qualified buyers for a private placement for 500,000 shares of stock. Let me see if I got... I do hope I wrote this down so that it actually works. It always works in practice, but sometimes it really doesn't work too well. Oh, okay. You want to sell 500,000 shares. Now, investors step up to the plate. And offer you money for each share. Well, let me do it this way. Number of shares the investor would be willing to buy and what they would pay for them. And if I do this right, 5,100, I've done this so many times, I should remember this, but I think I did the numbers a little differently this time. And I'll read these. And the bids are this, and I'll read these off just for the podcast. 57, 55, and 53. So investor one would buy 50,000 shares at $63. Investor two would buy 100,000 shares at $61. Investor three would buy 150,000 shares at $59. Investor four, 200,000 shares at $57. Investor 5, 250,000 shares at 55, and investor 6, 300,000 shares at 53. Now, in reality, it would be a little bit more complex than this, but one thing you would see is that the classic economic law of demand usually shows itself. See, at lower prices, you'll have investors who would be willing to buy more shares. Just kind of, it really plays itself out in the real world, although you get some weird little twists in the actual process if you ever did this for real. The thing, though, is that you see, I need to get 500,000 shares subscribed. And undersubscribe is not going to happen. And we tried not to oversubscribe too much because we have to give back. Now, you see, I'd love to have investor one be my investor. Him alone, he's offering $63. But he would buy only 50,000 shares. Ain't nobody else going to pay $63. So I would way undersubscribe. Now, if you don't see what I'm doing, for heaven's sakes, just tell me, because the first times I saw this, it didn't quite catch with me. Again, investor one is really attractive, $63 a share, but that investor would buy only 50,000 shares, and no other investor is going to participate in the offering at that price. So, okay, well, investor two would buy 100,000 shares and pay me 61. And of course, investor one would jump in on that. Yeah, I was going to pay 63, but if you're saying 61, sure. So if I set the price at 61, I'd get 150,000 shares. I'm still grossly undersubscribed. Now, if I go to investor three at 150,000 shares, well, there's my friend. But he's offering only $59 a share. But of course, I would also have investor two and investor one participate because they wouldn't have to pay what they were originally willing. Okay? So we would get what in economics is called some consumer surplus for them. Someone who's willing to pay 61 but has to pay only 59, well, that's a little surplus for him in a consumer sense. But still, I have only 300,000 shares subscribed. I'm undersubscribed again. So let's go to investor four. Well, 57. He's going to buy 200,000. But that would mean three, two, and one would also participate because they were willing to pay more. 200,000 plus 150,000 plus 100,000 plus 50,000 Yahtzee. I've subscribed it perfectly. So, what's my equilibrium? In a Dutch auction, it would be $57. You work your way down until you get enough people to say yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Would it be just a little bit higher with the shareholders who got a cheaper price, be willing to get more shares but paying a lower price?
I wish, but you see, that would be theoretically yes. Now, in other words, this guy was willing to pay 63. If he's willing to pay only 57, well, yeah, that's great. And he'd probably buy more. But the integrity of the auction, if I let him buy more, then I would deny these people who had been willing to bid less their shot. You see, they say, wait a minute, this jerk, he was asking 63, and now you're going to let him have the whole damn thing or a giant share of it at the lower price? Not unless he's willing, not because these guys are going to say, next time you have a Dutch auction, we're not going to participate because you give the high bidder favor over lower bidders, and that would ruin your reputation in these kinds of auctions. I see your point, though. It's a very good point, but it would just realistically, a Dutch auction would never, you would not want to do that because your reputation would be shot with people who had been willing to offer less, and then you screw them over for someone who originally tried to screw you over. I don't give rewards like that. Yeah, you get your 50,000 shares at 57, but you get no more because there are people who are willing to pay less to right off the bat. Good question, though. Now, that is a Dutch auction, and it's kind of an interesting thing because most people, they're familiar with the English auction. The Dutch auction kind of catches them off guard because you don't think that the world is like that, but actually the world of business is more likely to be a Dutch auction because we're trying to drive price down to find the cheapest way to get something done. And that's the same way with sealed bid auctions, too. Obviously, the English auction favors the seller. The Dutch auction favors the buyer. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah. So, there you go. That's an introduction, not terribly realistic, but go ahead. Yeah. I'd have to because if I, good question. See, if that had been a 220,000, let's say, then I would have oversubscribed it. You follow me? What I would probably have, a smart move would have been to say, your offer of number of shares to purchase is the maximum we will sell you. So I would have to clip off the guy there at the, at 50,000 and say, okay, if this guy's going to buy 220,000, you were going to buy 50,000, we'll still sell you 30,000. That's an excellent question, though. Yeah.
And then, so if investor one was willing to pay $63 and we were still going to sell them, why would they not be selling that or buying that
63? He's going to hear about 57. He's not going to take. Are you selling him 57? There would be what is called the law of one price would take hold immediately, because this is those investors. He knows someone's getting it for 57, and he says, "Screw you! I'm not paying more than 57." That's out. The law of one price says that regardless of where you are, the price that is set at the equilibrium, which is here 57. Is going to be the price that everyone pays, unless you're in some kind of a price discrimination market, which you might have heard about in economics. Now, there's an interesting example of this, and I'm not sure if I told you or not. I can't remember. Everything's a blur after 40 years. There was a company, it's a kind of a famous story. This was a beer company that started out as sort of a regional. I think it actually started out as a craft brew, and then it grew in popularity, and it was being sold quite a few places around the country. This was back many years ago. And the company was growing. I mean, you start out as a craft brew. You know, you got your restaurant, you got this, probably got a brewery thing, you know, your still or whatever, right there in the middle of the place. And then you're starting to sell, okay, well, we've got this grocery store wants to buy ours. Now there's some grocery stores out of state that want to buy. And so this company was just growing very rapidly. And they realized they're going to need more capital than they could get going to the bank. Now, a bank is what is called an indirect financial intermediary, as opposed to a direct financial or an investment bank. They were just going to the bank to borrow money, and the local banks were saying, are you kidding me? You want to do what? You want to make a gigantic brewery? Because, no, we can't afford to do this. And so they had talked with some investment bankers. Those are indirect intermediaries that actually buy subscriptions. They buy the whole thing, and then they sell it to their clients. That's not really, but that there was a suspicion about it. The investment bankers wanted a lot of money, which they do, to do this. And they were also asking all kinds of questions that showed that they really didn't understand the microbrewery business. So they decided, they talked to some consultants, people actually very similar to the kind of stuff that I did. And they said, well, do a self-offering, a self-underwriting. In other words, you do the paperwork with the SEC, and then you sell the stock yourself. And they said, well, that sounds like an idea. Okay. Now, if you do certain kinds of sales of stock, you don't have to do all of the paperwork. There are these exemptions. And as long as you fall under a certain amount of money you've raised, you can get away, you can get out from under an ungodly amount of paperwork that is usually done in a public offering. Well, they figured out, their consultant said, there's an exemption that allows you to raise $5 million, I think it was, on an exemption in Regulation A of securities law. Regulation A allows you to sell up to a certain amount of money in stock, and you don't have to file all this insane paperwork. So they thought, well, this is a good idea. And then the brilliant idea. Now, when you sell stock at a public offering, the selling document is called a prospectus. With these exemptions, it's still a selling document, looks like a prospectus, but it doesn't have to meet all of the jumps and hurdles. It's called an offering circular. The genius of this company was that their six-pack bottles, they were putting an offering circular in each of the six packs, selling them across the country. Brilliant. You got, you know, Joe Hohandel and his drunken buddies are drinking their beer. What the hell is this? Offering circular. Well, they're selling stock of this company. Well, this is damn. This beer makes me drunk and I have to pee a lot. Yeah. They sold that. I mean, they sold. Reg A is $7 million, I think. They sold tens and tens of millions of dollars of their stock. It was insane. They were just, the money was just rolling in. Back then, you mailed money. You didn't have wire transfer. And people were tearing out the thing in this offering circular. You know, I will buy 100 shares, or I will buy 1,000 shares. Here's my check. And I mean, it was just pouring in millions and millions of dollars. Well, the company officials were, ha, 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 look at all this money. We're going to be. And then the SEC said, you invoked Regulation A. $7 million. What have you collected now? $58 million. Well, first, you have to give all of the money back, and you're going to pay us a fine of quite a few million dollars for violating the rules of a Regulation A exemption from registration. And then you will not be allowed to try again for 1 year. I think it was a year, or maybe it was three. But anyway, oversubscription. They thought it was the greatest thing that had ever happened. Everyone loves our beer. And turned out that that was an oversubscription. And if you do it in reliance on an exemption from registration, you have to immediately send the money back, shut off the offer. But you understand that because they put these offering circulars in bottles of beer, they had no way to stop the auction process. They had no way to turn it off because it was already out there. Everyone was drinking, getting drunk, buying the stock. You couldn't call every beer drinker who bought that beer and say, that offering circular is invalid. It was brilliant on its face. And it turned out to be an absolute fiasco on the back end. And lesson learned, don't have an oversubscription to your offering. But anyway, so this can actually happen in the real world. Interestingly, if you were to think about what they did wrong, aside from being stupid, what did they do wrong? Why did this go south? Go. Well, clearly, they didn't understand that they could have just sent the money back. I'm sorry. That's clearly what they should have done after the fact. And they just, if someone sends me a check for $15 million and I'm allowed to take only $12 million, I'm going to have a hard time saying no. But on the front end, is there anything that seems to be obvious now? You see, their price was too low. That was why, they were offering the stock at clearly what a price that was going to cause the demand to be way too high. They didn't have the experience, and their consultant was an idiot, to understand that they should have done some kind of a focus group, something. Well, at what? How much would you buy at this price? Would you buy at this price? So if they offered it at $8 a share and they got that kind of insane oversubscription, clearly they did not price it right on the front end. Probably, I've seen some research papers on this one. What would have been the appropriate price? Armchair quarterbacking and all of that from on Monday morning, but realistically, they probably could have subscribed it out easily at $20, $22 a share. But they didn't do that kind of legwork to say what would people buy this at. What's their ouch price? Markets. This gets a little bit. Says save, challenge accepted. Does this one say save? Yep. You know how that works. I was sitting at this movie theater and this guy walks up to me and he's walking around, he's looking for a seat and he says, "Is that seat saved?" How should I know? I'm not evangelical. Markets. Madam, do you ever go to the market? You don't? You don't ever go to a market? I do. No, any kind of a market. Walmart's a market. Fresh Market was a market, but they closed that great place down. IGA is a market. The Forum New York Stock Exchange is a market. A car dealership is a market. The word market can mean so many different things. When I say the market, well, that probably means I'm looking at the stock market. But if you're looking at securities, there are the stock market, the bond market, the futures market. There are commodities markets, and there are spot markets, there are forward markets. A spot market is one where you take the price right at the time. A forward would be one where you agree to a price over a period of time. Now, in a spot versus forward, I'll give you a great example from my own life. When I was in oil and gas exploration in Texas, we were just wildcatters, all, just these pieces of trash. We had a really good petrogeologist. So he could just kind of look at a place and kind of have a feeling if there was oil there. But we're not talking about those gushers. You're going to punch a hole, another hole, 15 holes before you'll finally get one. It'll yield maybe 50 barrels a day if you're really lucky. But anyway, we'd sometimes punch and get some crude out of the ground. We were doing okay. It would collect into tanks with a pump jack. You get the drill out, you get the pump jack set up on it, and it would start pulling the oil. You'd put it into the reserve tanks. And then the truck would come around to buy your oil. Now, cocaline was pretty common in the day. Now, here's how it would work. The cocaine driver would say, "Okay, I can pay you what the spot is. In other words, right there, I know what the price is right now, and I'll pay you that per barrel. Pay you $15 a barrel. Or I will contract with you and buy all the oil you have for the next 6 months at $12 a barrel." Now, you see where the problem is. It's a spot. If the spot is above, is good, I'll take the spot. But what happens if the spot drops to 9.8? The oil prices could go up and down, especially with this crap, the sour crude that was coming out of the oil patch and all that. So you can take the spot price, or you can set up a forward. Now, in your case, ma'am, when you go out to get your first career job, are you going to be offered spot or forward? Yahtzee, exactly. You will agree to a salary for a period of time, regardless of what happens to salaries in your field. Okay, that's a forward. That's clearly a forward. Now, when you go to the gas station to buy gasoline, ma'am, are you buying spot or forward? Bingo. Whatever that price is, you're just going to take the spot on it. So markets exist. You're going to live in both kinds of markets, spot markets, forward markets. Now, the interesting thing is that supposedly a lot of contracts have a forward provision. But anymore, companies rely on the fact that contract law is falling apart in the electronic world to screw you over. For example, I got a notice from Netflix that they were just going to jack up the price of my subscription. Okay? So in other words, when I subscribe to you, I'm not buying on a forward contract guaranteed a price for a year. You'll just do whatever the hell you want, whenever you want. So what seems like a forward contract, which is very normal for a subscription, turns out to be a spot contract, whatever they feel like doing. What are you going to do? Well, I'll teach you a lesson, Netflix. I won't use your service anymore. Meaner. Well, they are not going to give a rat's ass about that. And they rely on that. They can change for what seems to be forward to spot whenever they want to. So that's the idea of two different kinds of markets, the spot market and the forward market. Now, interestingly enough, futures are actually forward contracts in the sense that, let's try this. Do you eat pork? Good. So do I. I had pork chops last night. They were delicious because I put them in this crock pot. Oh, anyway, okay, so try to stay focused. Okay. Now, you really like pork, so what you'd like to do is buy pork bellies. Let's say maybe 100,000 pounds of pork bellies. You're having a party, okay? But you're not going to have that party for, let's say, 2 weeks. So, well, the price of pork bellies is pretty low right now. What I might want to do is contract to guarantee purchase in 2 weeks of 100,000 pounds of pork bellies at the current price. Do you see the forward nature of that? Okay, not as a spot, because I'm afraid the spot would be higher. So I'm going to contract. If you understand that, you understand the basis of a futures contract. You are simply contracting to accept delivery in the future for a price that is set now. Now, that doesn't mean you have to actually take them. Hardly any futures contracts ever close with delivery. You just simply take the opposite side of the contract. As a matter of fact, that's how they're set up, is so that at 2 weeks, you don't get your pork bellies. All you do is the position that you had is closed with an opposite position for you. And all you do is collect the difference between the price of the contract then and the price you paid for it now. But I'll get into that more later. But that gives you an idea of a futures market and how that's a classic example of a forward market. There are so many different kinds of markets, though. There are markets for physical assets. And this is, title of this is markets. There's a market for physical assets, and there's a market for financial assets. Ma'am, someday you will own a car. She's ignoring me. You will own a car someday. It won't be a nice car, but it'll be an okay car. And it won't be one of those tiny little cars. Don't get one of those. Those are just, I mean, I'm the kind of person who likes to drive over those in my SUV. But you're going to buy a car. That's a physical asset. That's a market. You buy food at the store. You buy a new toaster. You buy something that actually has tangible existence. That's a physical market. But we are, in this story, we are in financial assets. Stocks, bonds. Have you ever held a share of stock in your hand, ma'am? Yeah. You haven't, have you? Well, do you have them in your hands, or do you have them in a drawer? Yeah, well, you know what? How much is that piece of paper worth just as a piece of paper? It's worth nothing, actually. Well, it's worth a tiny amount of money. But really, it doesn't have any value in and of itself. It is what is behind it that has the value. So financial assets have an asset behind them that they represent. In fact, that bond actually doesn't even represent anything physical. It represents a claim on a cash flow. Just like a share of stock represents a residual claim on a cash flow, a bond represents a claim on a prior cash flow of a corporation. So even what they represent doesn't represent anything. You are going to own a house someday a trailer, double wide, south side of Decatur. I've learned to stop making fun of Decatur because people keep getting mad at me. My mom's from Decatur. Yes, I know she is, son. Met her at the parking lot and the truck stop. I didn't say that. I have to edit this. We'll go on this in the next lecture. I thank you.